got most of his training in the grocery business working at that Century Foods, where he decided, hey, there's a niche that needs to be met, and that is in Asian groceries. In the early 90s, my parents came to one or two stores in Milwaukee. But what my dad did was he took his experience from a chain grocery store that was very clean and a very Americanized, and he brought in a lot of Asian groceries and sold to American people, to Japanese people, people that needed certain specialty items sourced. He brought those items in for them.
Hello, and welcome to Food Crush, the On Milwaukee podcast for people who eat. As always, I am your co-host, Matt Miller, culture editor at onmilwaukee.com, and I am joined, as always, by dining editor at onmilwaukee.com, Lori Frederick. How you doing, Lori?
I'm good, but I'm hungry, which is a total mistake.
Lori, why do you keep doing this to yourself? About
food? I don't know.
You knew this was going to happen. I made mac and cheese. I came prepared today.
I know.
I even threw a little chorizo in it because I was bored. And I was like,
Yeah, don't rub it in.
I mean, I could tell you my whole week's dining plans if you would like, if that would make you feel hungrier. Or we could talk to some lovely people who run a wonderful restaurant that makes delicious food. Would that make you hungrier?
Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah, let's decimate your hunger. And
I was going to say, maybe I can distract myself. With conversation.
So, I don't think this is a good strategy, Lori. I think this is going to end bad for you.
We'll see if I make it to the end. There we go. So, no, but I'm excited because we are here with Kat Tran and Mark Nielsen, the operators, chefs behind Hue, Vietnamese restaurant, a restaurant that's been around for a remarkably long time. I'm in my whirl. I'm trying to remember at the last minute, like when exactly you guys opened. But
we opened, I believe, May of 2010.
I'm glad you paused with that because I was like, I know it's been 10 years, or at least I feel like it's been at least 10 years.
Our first Hue article in the On Milwaukee archives, not including an article about Huey Lewis for some odd reason, was May 22nd, 2010.
Wow.
Okay.
I think we opened May 9th of 2010.
And I was going to
say. Was it May 9th or May 10th, I believe? Yeah. It was
surprisingly,
Tuesday.
Our new Bayview restaurant opened May 9th of 2022.
Your coordination skills are impeccable.
Time is a flat circle, I guess.
We totally planned that all on purpose. Everything works out just perfect.
That's impressive because the world nowadays, so few things are actually, under anyone's control.
The article is so old that Lori didn't even write it. It was a previous food writer on Milwaukee.
I did do a piece on Hue, but I think it was...
The next year you did one called Make Your Way to Hue, because Lori does love her wordplay. And then
there's a lot there to work with.
Well, people at that point still needed to know how to pronounce the name of the restaurant.
That's right.
And I remember thinking, like, how can I make this fun and still, tell people not to call it Hue?
In the oldest days of, having to explain what pho was. And, it was different times back in 2010.
Definitely was. Yeah. Well, and I think your story will kind of illustrate that because I think, so I don't know. Let's go back because the origins, I feel like the origins of Hue go back to way before you decided to open a restaurant.
Yes. Well, first, Lori and Matt, thanks for having us on the podcast. We don't tell our story very often. And maybe it's because we're deep in our daily operations. And sometimes I think that, it's this progression that I go through where I kind of feel like my story is the same as every other refugee story. So sometimes I just don't share it because everyone else shares it. It comes out on occasion. So I'm happy to share it today. But my history is that I grew up in a small town in southern Wisconsin, about 60 miles from here or so, in Delavan. And my parents came over in 1975. They actually left Vietnam on April 29th, or they were sat in the bay of Da Nang on April 29th. And as we all know, the fall of Saigon happened on April 30th, and that's when they left Vietnam. So we came over and were sponsored in from a group of churches in southern Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. First, my family landed in Fort Chaffee, Arkansas, which was an army base. And that's where there is maybe two or three bases that all the refugees were kind of settled out to. And mm-hmm. we were in Fort Chaffee where I was born. So
your mom was very pregnant with you. Oh, wow. That's an incredible time to leave.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're talking 20 days or so after they arrived in the U.S. And
she had two young daughters in tow with her as well.
Yeah.
1-year-old and a 3-year-old. So,
wow. Your mom is my hero, truly.
She's pretty fun. So she, when my parents were sponsored out, it was interesting because we were the only Vietnamese family in southern Wisconsin. A couple of years later, a couple of other families joined, but even my grandparents were placed in Missouri. You kind of just went wherever you were placed as refugees. Yep. And so many people would have preferred to go to California, you know, because the weather is much closer to what you'd see in Vietnam or mm-hmm. to the warmer climate. So I think that we were pretty strong just because we were placed in Wisconsin and we had to deal with snow and deal yes. with not having other Vietnamese families around, mm-hmm. things of that nature. Culturally, it was hard. My parents, when you're raising and you're living in an unknown land, you kind of want your children to integrate to what is the American way. So they spoke very little Vietnamese. They spoke Vietnamese to each other. They didn't speak it to their children. My grandma was here. She didn't speak any English. She lived with us. So I understand Vietnamese very well. I speak very little. The tongue is just... and the accents are hard. It's a tonal language. So if I do try to speak it, my family in Vietnam, they have no idea what I'm saying. They can kind of gather what I'm trying to say.
You probably have an accent. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. And not knowing this, I didn't realize that even the people of Central Vietnam and Hue, their accent is kind of like similar to what we'd see in the southern U.S., like the southern accent. So even people in Vietnam have trouble understanding people in Hue because their accent's so thick. So it is interesting to hear our 5-year-old speak Vietnamese because he has he can do some Vietnamese, but people when he speaks, people automatically say he has a Hue accent. So it's pretty cute that that's what he's learning. So in any case, me personally rejected my culture, rejected being Vietnamese because my parents they wanted us to grow up American. We didn't have any friends in the area that were Vietnamese either. And I remember a couple of stories in high school, one of which was, it's a small town in southern Wisconsin, so people didn't even realize that like Vietnam was different than China, different than any other Southeast or Asian country. So I remember a girl, we were watching like a quick video in class and they were speaking in Chinese and she's like, "Hey, Karina, what are they saying?" And I was like, "I don't know," you know, like, and so she wasn't even aware that we are all from different countries. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of, so you just kind of decide, okay, well, they don't know. And why should I try to educate what occurred to us, to my family as we were trying to make our way in southern Wisconsin. And then, you know, but then there's still the traditions at home. Traditions of we ate Vietnamese food every day. And some friends would come over and I remember a girl came over and she wasn't a close friend, but she said, "Oh, what is that smell?" And my mom is like, "She cooked with fish sauce." Right? And fish sauce is delicious, but it was unfamiliar to this mm-hmm. girl. And my mom's like, she's never to come over again because she didn't accept the traditions that we had in our house. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my mom took offense to that she was just kind of like, ugh, you know? So, and absolutely. In retrospect, that's kind of some of the reasons why I kind of grew up kind of pushing back
away from it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and I would imagine that parents who bring their kids to the U.S., you know, and that they're looking for something. I mean, they people leave countries for, you know, a reason. I mean, there's always hardships and, you know, I mean, war and struggle. And I think parents just want their kids to have a better situation, right?
Absolutely.
And, you know, I think for a lot of people, it was about sparing people having to explain, you know, it's like, well, you know, you just come, you be American. And I mean, but although that divorces a lot of people from, you know, from the cultures that they came from.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that's a common story though. I think everybody's plays out in a really different way, across time. So
we actually ended up like opening, Mark and I both came from corporate America. We did different things. We, you know, went to college and did that stuff and ended up in corporate America. And was it 2009? Yeah, with the recession, I had lost my job. I was corporate event planning. Mark was doing some, you were working at a electronics, what were you doing?
I was a commodity electronics broker.
Yeah. And he had the hospitality.
That always sounds so exciting.
Yeah, it's not a normal, it's not a normal title. It's not, you know, butcher, baker, yeah. Candlestick maker. It's
But
he had the some hospitality background, and I planned events, so I knew enough about food and entertaining and things like that. But what Milwaukee was missing was really, and it had some really good Vietnamese restaurants, but not in the kind of environment in which we wanted to eat at. And one of the stories I have is that, you know, we frequented them a lot, the Vietnamese restaurants that were here back in the late 90s. My parents had a grocery store in Milwaukee, an Asian grocery store. Mm-hmm. So we spent a lot of time in Milwaukee, and there are a few that we went to, but I actually remember sitting at one of them and literally a cockroach ran like across I was like, yeah, like across the table. And you're like, oh man, like this is such a bummer, but the food is so good. So what do you do then? And so there were a couple of places in Chicago, and Mark and I had gone down and checked them out. And we're like, why don't we try to do this? I don't want to go back into corporate America. He was kind of like all right with his job, but like, why not own our own business? So that's where kind of our business came from, was just like there was a niche that needed to be met in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. And what do we know, and who do we want to bring into our business? And a bit of that came from my dad also. My dad was a captain in the South Vietnamese Navy, and he was an educated man. And when he came to the U.S., he was a bag boy at a Century Food store. And he got most of his training in the grocery business working at that Century Foods, where he decided, hey, there's a niche that needs to be met, and that is in Asian groceries. In the early 90s, my parents came to one or two stores in Milwaukee. But what my dad did was he took his experience from a chain grocery store that was very clean and a very Americanized, and he brought in a lot of Asian groceries and sold to American people, to Japanese people, people that needed certain specialty items sourced. He brought those items in for them. So his grocery store with the exception of the fact that it was Asian foods, you wouldn't be able to tell if it was a Century or a Pick and Save, you know? And that in the late 90s was kind of a big deal because there wasn't, that was a niche.
Yeah. And that was kind of the growing era of the kind of the food networkization of food. Yeah. Some people were learning a lot more like about, you know, foods that they may have never tried before, and cooking things that they may have never tried before. So
well, and it was a time too where I think that well, there were definitely Vietnamese restaurants in Milwaukee. People hadn't completely gotten comfortable with exploring, you know, the different restaurants, you know, that they were less familiar with. So,
yeah, it was uncharted territory for sure. I mean, and about that time, 2009, 2008, around there, that was when you started to get, you know, the Anthony Bourdain thing started coming about, you know, rest in peace. And there's a lot of talk, and people got interested in Vietnamese food and they wanted to start knowing more about it. And so we felt there's some momentum there to keep going with that. Yeah. But we also realized, you know, we're in Milwaukee, and it's there's not always the most progressive food-wise to do things. You know, there's some people that were really, that I feel were really pioneers in Milwaukee, that, you know, people like Joe Barlotta and people like that, that that brought different kinds of food to this city that was really meat and potatoes, and said, hey, there's other stuff we can do. We can do higher end Italian and seafood and things like that, you know, to bring other, even other ethnicities, other ethnic foods in. So it's there was some groundwork that was laid already, and there was also some kind of some energy under, you know, bubbling underneath that we looked at and said, hey, this is probably the best time to do this. If we're going to do it, let's do it now.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. No, I mean, when you look at Milwaukee and 10, 15 years ago, I always tell people, if the last time you were here was over 10 years ago, you need to come back. Yeah. Because it's a very different place.
Well, I tell this story too much on this podcast, but I always think back to some of my earliest days at On Milwaukee in 2012. And the idea of a restaurant selling ramen was just unfathomable to people in the comments. And was just like, why would I pay decent money for ramen? What is this? What is this business?
I don't know. Familiarity was,
because all people knew was, you know, cup noodles.
Yeah, and, people think ramen. I can make ramen at home. You know,
exactly.
Why would I go somewhere and pay for ramen?
Yeah, it's ten for a dollar.
Yeah, like, and that was literally 10 years ago. I remember, you know, us having the conversations in the office, having to be like, I can't believe people are reacting so angry to this. And it was just, you know, Milwaukee can take a bit to get to, you know, to new cuisines and to, you know,
the trends. Midwest in general, you know.
But like, they tend to, like, once they get a taste, they really like it. Like,
it's
they
weird
just have to
people,
be led to the water.
It's weird what people will get really upset about, and then weird stuff that's like, you think people like, oh, this is going to really stir things up a lot. And people are like, oh, no, that sounds great. We love it. And then there's some other just minutia thing that people just lose their minds over, and you're like, why are you so angry about this?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
I think one of the things that we tried to do when we opened was and it was kind of different, but we went out to like all of these festivals, Zoo a la Carte and Lakefront Festival of Art, and we didn't do a bunch of fried foods. Of course, we did egg rolls and crab rangoons, but we made spring rolls, and we did noodle bowls, and like, I think back to Zoo a la Carte, like, in 8 or 9 years ago when we started, like, it was so different, and people had no idea, like, what we were selling. And that was, like, part of, like, our strategy, too, was we have to get the food into people's mouths. They're not going to come down to Bayview, in our little restaurant in Bayview. We have to go out to them, and then they'll come down to the restaurant.
Yeah. Which, again, it's such a baffling sentence to hear, the idea of like you have to convince people to eat noodle bowls. Like, that was kind of, you know, it's
convince people. We had to explain to people, so individually, be like, okay, this is not a bowl of pasta. These noodles are served cool or cold. And sometimes our staff would be like, well, we tell them they're served cold. I'm like, don't say cold. That just doesn't sound good. They're served cool. You know, they're cool noodles. And then people would be like, well, everything on top is cold. Like, no, that's grilled, that's heated up. So there's different layers of food. So even how the food is made as a cuisine, of having different layers at different temperatures and having different flavor, salty and sweet, these abstracts kind of in there, that took a while. But once people got onto it, you know, you had to explain it to them the first time, but then they came back the next week and said, yeah, let me get another one of those.
Yeah. Which, again, that's kind of the you know, it's cliche at this point, but that's the power of food, that, you know, something on a page, or like you can tell someone like, oh, you, someone who might not know anything about Vietnam or anything like that, and they try some food and they're like, oh, like, I get this. This is great. Yeah. I want to learn more about what and who made this.
Yeah, I think we used to say that we'd have to, like, you know, go out to these festivals and events, and, you know, it would drag people into our restaurant and pin them down and shove the food in their mouth. And then they'd try it and they'd be like, why didn't you tell me it was like this? And, you know, and then we'd done our job.
Well, we've been trying. Yeah.
Well, and you talk about the kind of balance of when you're, you know, kind of exposing a market to a fairly new cuisine, trying to, like, how do you balance, you know, being authentic, which is a loaded word in its ways, but like being traditional while also playing to what, you know, the Milwaukee palate might be. How was that kind of process in those early days, trying to kind of figure out the best combination of, you know, authentic versus, you know, what Americans might think is authentic.
It was really hard.
Yeah, we started off, and overall, you can look at all of our stuff. We've never used the word authentic. And and that's there for a reason. And it is because we want to adapt to people's palates in our marketplace. We want to make food that people like here that will come and get it. We also wanted to make ourselves a restaurant that was more introductory to Vietnamese food. And you know, that goes into a longer story in itself. But our food, as it sits now, we have some of our food. Our pho recipe, I feel, is extremely authentic. It's even regional to Central Vietnam. But we have other things. We have our spicy crab rangoon, which is our top selling appetizer. There's nothing Vietnamese about it. It's just
delicious food.
Yeah, it was put together by one of our chefs, or one of our cooks that we had years and years ago, who was Laotian. And it was just amazing. We're like, this is like the best rangoons we've ever had. And so it's like, yeah, I don't know. There's nothing authentic about it, but it's really good, and that's what matters. And we've gotten, you know, blasted, of course, on the interwebs, as you will, about being, this place isn't authentic. And I'm like, well, we never said we were. And everyone's idea of authentic is completely different. You know, go for Italian food and go to... You know, go to Blue Mound Inn and go to Bartolotta's and then go to Tenuta's and Bayview. Pick which one's authentic. You're gonna get three different answers.
What's traditional or authentic too? It's granular. It's based on family to family. Because what is, you know, and I hate the word authentic and avoid using it whenever possible, because to me it's like things that can be authenticated are like Gucci bags. Like food can't. Because there is too much, too many variations and too many things like that.
Yeah. Well, and I think about the Ugly Delicious episode where he tries the pizza and stuff, and he's talking about, like, you know, for me, Domino's is authentic because that's what I grew up with. That's what good pizza tastes like to me. And sure, there can be, you know, platonically, you know, more Italian, better pizzas. But for me, that's what brings me comfort. That's what feels like my brain's definition of it. And you can get caught in like a trap of authenticity too, especially like there's so much room for creativity in food that, you know, the word authentic can be a prison in some ways.
Well, the other trap I think that you guys squarely do not fall into is, you know, is this idea that you need the foundation, you know, you need to know an awful lot about Vietnamese food. You need to have a foundation and know what that food is like, what the ingredient, you know, like you need to have that connection to it to do what you did and to riff on it and make it, you know, like I think what people didn't acknowledge the entire time is A, it would be pretty disingenuous for someone to come along, you know, and do the concept that you guys did with no connection at all to Vietnam, right? But you also
It's been done in other Asian cuisines.
Yeah, well, and I was going to say it's done all the time. But to me, it's kind of like, you know, when you have the foundation and the cuisine belongs to you, you know? And people are allowed to present it in different ways, you know? And I think your mission was, like, let's give people a really good way of getting to know this delicious food with all these herbs and fresh flavors. And this is how we want to approach this, you know. So
I think
people were inordinately hard on you, you know. It's like, and why aren't you being authentic? And it's like, well, that's not the point.
It wasn't just even the food. It was even like people coming in the door and saying, I want to see the person cooking the food. Are they Vietnamese?
Some of it got really ugly. I mean, we still get some of that. I mean, we've been... We have a very diverse staff, and we've been race checked online by people coming in complaining that there's no Asian people or that the people serving them the food are not Asian. So some pretty dark stuff sometimes, and we just we don't respond to it. We just move on. But
I think one of the hardest, I actually learned once Joe Bartolotta, when he was alive, came in and he said, "You need to stop reading those reviews." because they're gonna keep you up at night, and they're gonna make you really sad, and you're not gonna push to the things that are important to you if you read those reviews. And I think Mark had mentioned to him that a review came in and someone said, one, this place isn't authentic, and two, it wasn't dirty enough. And there was basically it goes back to my original story of there were no cockroaches running around, so it's not authentic. And I was like, man, and it was an Asian person. So it's not even just, the whites that check us. It's the Asian persons that do too, because we're not doing what they believe should be a Vietnamese restaurant.
We're probably the most love-hated restaurant for Vietnamese people in Milwaukee. Like, it's 50-50. You love us or you hate us. And we've had Vietnamese people that come to the restaurant, that come in regularly, and I had someone explain to me really well once, and they said, you know what? You're not like every other Vietnamese restaurant with some of the stereotypical, with the numbers and the name and, certain things, you're different. And if I want old school, Vietnamese food that they've been doing in this country, since the 70s, I know where I'm going to go. But if I have friends, especially if they're not Vietnamese, and they come into town and I want to take them someplace, and some of them maybe have never had Vietnamese food, I'll go to your place every time because I know that I can present the food well. And I just took that and said, that's what we're going to go on. That works. That works for us. And if you want your cookie cutter, the must be by the book, must have all these stereotypical things for a Vietnamese place, then, we're not your place, and that's okay.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, too, because in our talks with, in our talks, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, but it seems like so much of kind of Southeast Asian cuisine, a lot of this cuisine, the Venn diagram of a lot of the cuisines overlap significantly in a lot of places. And then you add in, Chinese and Japanese, and you add in, the Americanization of a lot of these cuisines. And this idea that there's a correct way to do it just kind of seems silly when all of these types of foods, and I mean, the same goes for all the Mexican food and Italian food, like all these foods have gone through such colossal evolutions that what is the objective, this is what the food is supposed to be at this point, why would we not,
I think it's interesting because if you had opened Tway now or in the last few years, there's so many instances where young chefs are coming to the scene and taking, whatever their cultural cuisine is, from any country you can imagine across the world, and playing with it, and coming out with these concepts that use the flavors inventively. And we're really super okay with that now. It's really interesting. I mean, because when you look at how Filipino food, for instance, is being represented across the U.S., this isn't the food necessarily that you're going to get if you go to the Philippines. And I think there's something actually really beautiful about that because it reflects the fact that this, there's still a reason to go and travel and eat food in different places because there's no way in some respects to replicate things. We've gotten to be a really global society, but there is nothing eating Vietnamese food in Hue, right?
sitting on the little plastic chairs outside of the little shop. I still say the best bowl of pho I've ever had was in Hoi An in Vietnam. Yeah. I swear there's something in the water. And you can go to Da Nang, which is about an hour away maybe, and the pho just tastes completely different. And it's just one of those once-in-a-lifetime things. You're like, wow, this is incredible. I mean, our pho is great, but that I've had pho in Hoi An, Vietnam. Mm-hmm. That's just, I'm like, yep, this is it.
Yeah. Well, and Kat, I remember you saying to me once that the food was sort of what brought you back. For as much as you'd spent part of your life saying, no, I'm kind of divorcing myself from all of this culture that makes it, tough to exist in the world because people ask too many questions and I have to explain myself too much. And, but the food was kind of what brought you back.
Yeah, I was probably missing it. And one of the things was that my mom, when my dad passed away, she became more, she became a stronger Buddhist. So she began eating very vegetarian, which some sects of Buddhism don't eat garlic or onion or anything that kind of taints your senses.
Oh, so it's strong, right?
Yes. Like,
and it's, yeah.
Yep. Okay. And so, like, you know, sometimes, like, when you eat our Nook Mum at the restaurant, it is, you'll go home and you'll still taste the garlic the next day.
I love that. Oh, yeah.
And you don't, and definitely if you're on a date, you don't want, you and your date should be eating that Nook Mum.
Because
if one of you does, if one of you does, the other one's not going to be, you know.
Yeah.
So, one of the things is that we kind of started missing, and because of, she started cooking food, mostly vegetarian, and taking out like the garlic and the onions, she was an amazing cook. But she started to forget how to cook some of these dishes. So we were missing, my sisters and I were kind of missing, like, man, do you remember when Mom used to make that? Or, you know, and so some of it is really like, selfishly, like, we don't want to lose her recipes, you know, and we don't want to lose how she used to cook those dishes. So on occasion, I used to do specials and with more of the like specialty dishes that she did. And right now, most of her menu is pretty main. I call it mainstream because it's, you know, beef skewers and egg rolls, just, you know, very common
things that people understand. Know, yeah, exactly.
But doing more intricate dishes on special, and it's like I remember eating those when I was younger, and just like missing that she's forgotten how to make the dishes, but she also doesn't remember the flavor of them because she doesn't eat a lot of garlic or onions or peppers anymore.
Sure. So, yeah, sure, yeah. And I was going to say, and now you probably like make certain things, and you can just like you're just blasted back to this
some
place.
Of the biggest compliments, because the lemongrass beef skewers are they're very strong seller bars. But a compliment when people from Hue come over and they eat those, they're like, "Man, you know those are from the person that is from Hue that made these." And I really love that because that's just something about like getting that validation from them is makes me feel good that we're doing something right.
So did you learn a lot of like recipes, go back to your mom, and did she kind of teach you? Or
well, no, it wasn't like a formal sitting down, but like we were always in the kitchen helping her cook, like in many many families where, you know, when you're I have a part of my thumb is missing because I had to use a mandolin when I was literally like 4 years old.
Oh, no.
And like slice part of it off, you know, like, and I was like four, you know, so we were always in the kitchen.
You were more highly skilled besides cutting your thumb.
Right.
Like, which
I
anyone
didn't find
could
out
do
what a
with a mandolin
was until I was like 17.
We had to do the cut
myself on one.
And like, you know, we had to, it was lousy, but we had to sit and help roll egg rolls because roll egg rolls when we were younger and they were terrible looking, but we still had to do it. My sisters and I had to peel and cut. And back in those days, it was a little bit more difficult because she would hand cut the cabbage for egg rolls and not use like a processor. And she would also process pork for, you know, like for the egg rolls with a processor. So things like that took a little bit more time, but it was always her and my grandma would do everything from scratch, and it was painstaking. So I had two sisters. We all had to sit and help do it all.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
At a young age.
I'd love to, we talked a little bit about Hue and you, that kind of particular food kind of, what do you say where are some like defining culinary aspects of that kind of area and city and region of Vietnam?
We've been to Hue. I've been there three times, and there are a few dishes that, and unfortunately we don't have them all in our we don't have any in our restaurant, but there are a couple dishes I remember. They snails and eating dishes.
Oh,
there's a couple of dishes that have like, it's basically rice with snails and a very pungent like shrimp paste.
Is that that's French influence?
Yes.
Like, that kind of weaves through. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then there's a lot of the fresh herbs that go on top. So you're basically mixing like a big rice bowl together. Mm-hmm. And in Hue also, there tends to be a little bit more of the, And I hate to say spice because the spices can be added in, but the Thai chilies are always cut very, very thinly and small and then added. So I don't find the spice to be an overwhelming spice versus because you're like cutting things so thinly and delicately, it's just like a nice heat. Yeah. But it's more pungent like the I don't know, Lori, if you've ever had like shrimp paste with like lime and so it's very strong and it smells very strong too, but it's something about it, it's fermented, it just adds something to the dishes. So there's when we go there, it's a lot of that fermented shrimp paste that you would add kind of like the Nook Mom as a dressing over the top of everything.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of some of the other dishes like my aunt would just take us to.
There's always bún bò Huế, which we've wrestled with that for years because it's a dish and we catch flack for it. Sometimes be like, hey, you're called Huế, you don't make bún bò Huế. That's kind of a signature dish. Mm-hmm. And there's reasons
it's got a cool
to
name.
It's a cool name. Yeah. And there's a couple reasons. I mean, it's a little bit of a challenging dish to make. And then also, I think for people who are not Vietnamese, which, you know, we'll be honest, is a majority of our market, it's a challenging dish to eat sometimes. I think the flavor's pretty intense. People go down the bottom of the bowl and there's a big chunk of oxtail in there, and that can scare people off a little bit sometimes.
Oxtail, pork hocks, you would add some of the blood sausage to it as well. Mm-hmm. You would add banana flour and freshly cut, finely cut sliced cabbage and things to the top. And that dish, I just remember because my mother would always make it for, they would, you know, late night party with friends in their younger years. And she'd always have a huge pot of it ready to go at 2 o'clock when everyone would drive home because you'd sweat out. That it's kind of like you'd sweat out all of the alcohol and stuff. And so everyone would leave just like sweating because it's very spicy and with a full belly. And then they could just, everyone could drive home. Not that we're, you know, saying okay to drive home after drinking. Right. But,
and then,
It was the early 80s. It was a different time.
Right.
Yeah. So,
which doesn't mean we might bring it back, though. We could do it sometime in the future.
But the translation is just like beef noodle from Huế. Beef noodles from Huế is bún bò Huế.
Yeah. So kind of a soup noodle.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And the noodles are usually reminiscent of like more like spaghetti. So thicker noodles, not like a pho noodle, but they're rice noodles. A thicker vermicelli. So,
okay.
And then you'd put them in a soup.
Yeah.
But it's real nice. It's very meaty.
Yeah. You've talked me into making that like a late night drunk eat or something like that.
I will let you know when we make it. You can
stand around for hours during the day making your pot of soup. Yeah. So
that I've had it before. It works. Trust me. It does the trick.
So it's kind of like late night ramen or late night pho. I don't know. Yeah. Pho is the answer to many ills and illnesses. Like,
fucking be good for the next day.
It's sort of interesting because you can tell by looking at me that there's no way that I have any Vietnamese in my in my heritage. However, like that is the chicken noodle soup of my. I don't know how this happened. It just was a love affair. But
we sell a lot of fun. Sunday morning, Sunday lunch. We sell a lot of fun.
So that makes sense to me. But it's also, it's what I crave. I mean, if I've had a long day and, you know, especially in the middle of winter, that's all I want.
So how has the kind of restaurant evolved from those kind of, we've talked a lot about kind of the early days and kind of that kind of first stepping into the kind of, how has it evolved over these last 10 years, would you say?
And did that, and I'm kind of curious too, did it go according to plan or did you?
Yeah.
I think we're very, Mark and I are very, I'm a planner. Mm-hmm. I think that where we are today, everything went to plan. With our location in Bayview and kind of getting out from under leasing space and things like that. We knew that when we left corporate, our destiny was in our hands. So there's no, if we were going to fail, it's because we failed, not because someone else did something to us. It was bad decisions. We made those decisions. No one else forced those decisions on us. So we knew that whatever we were going to build out of this, and this was also because both, like, my parents never wanted us to go into the grocery business or into the restaurant business. That's kind of like one of the American dream things. They can work really hard, but their kids have to work right. better jobs, office jobs, easier jobs, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that Mark's family probably thought the same. They wanted him to not have to struggle. And so I think for both of us, leaving our cushy corporate jobs was to go to a restaurant wasn't a real job for them. They thought it was maybe
so
just
there was some resistance in that at first?
In assistance in opening the business?
Resistance.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Resistance
It took a while. I remember seeing Kat really struggling with justifying it to her mom at the time, and, you know, saying, you know, she's like, do you know what you're doing? You know, and as a parent as well, I know that Asian mothers can be a bit critical sometimes. And that took a while. And then when I think she started to see that we were having some success and that we started to take things in our own direction to make it what was ours and not be like everyone else, that it justified itself quickly and it felt a little bit better. And I think, the plan is worked. I mean, you're always looking forward and you always have to see where, you know, it's not a race car. It's a ship and you got to make course adjustments. And I think our big goal when we first started off was kind of alluding to what Kat was saying earlier is that there was a lot of stereotypes about this food. And so when we came out in 2010, our mission was, we can take this food and we can present it in a way that makes it presentable, that presents it in a way that's clean, that has some that has a little more, stepped up a little bit, a little more class to it. And we accomplished that. We did that in Bayview. We went out with our Wauwatosa location for 7 years and we did that. And then we realized that coming up, you know, three, 4 years ago, we started saying, okay, we've done that. We've accomplished that. And now almost so much to the point where it's starting to get kind of a little stuffy, a little boring, you know, that there wasn't a lot of excitement there sometimes in the overall vibe of the restaurant and kind of what we were doing. And so one of the goals we had with this new location in the new project in Bayview was that we kind of wanted to change how we presented things a little bit. So the new restaurant is brighter. There's more going on. It's a little louder. There's more stuff on the walls. The traditional oil paintings from Hui, we took those and we screwed them to the ceiling. Just to shake stuff up a little bit, just to make things a little bit different and to kind of show that we're kind of going a little bit more of a direction of more fun, a little more maybe like Southern California style. We've had some customers that, you know, don't like that and that's okay. But we've had a lot of other people come in and say, hey, this new place, it's refreshing. It's fun. It's loud. It's exciting. We got called the Bel Air of Asian food once, and that was and I looked at him like, I'm like, that's not all bad. Scott and Leslie and those guys over there, they do what they do pretty well. So we, it's just more of having our direction in our hands, and
it also gives us with the new being more fun and a little bit less following the rules, it gives us an opportunity to do more with food. Mm-hmm. So, and without anyone like, okay, you already judged me on the location and you may or may not like the environment you're in, but now I'm going to throw out more stuff, more food things, and you may or may not like those, but you know, you already judged me on one thing. So we're just going to go and do whatever we want this time.
Well,
so
in the end with all of this, it's like, if everybody likes you, you're probably doing something wrong. Like, you know, it sounds counterintuitive.
But if you appeal to everyone.
Yeah.
Nobody in this game has everyone.
What is that? Like, you're just not possible. Like, that's the most boring thing in the restaurant industry ever, right? Like,
well, then you're McDonald's, and even McDonald's is hated because McDonald's is for everybody.
It's consistent. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. What do the parents think of the restaurant now, Kat?
It's, you know, I'm just trying to, I think my mom loves, she doesn't, I think what's really hard is that she doesn't see it as just like us as a restaurant. I think that, you know, it goes along to the critical Asian parent thing. We also, I mean, Mark and I side hustle a lot. So we also do a little bit of real estate on the side. So she sees the whole picture of it like, oh, they have a restaurant and they work really hard, but oh, they were able to accumulate some real estate. And that's where she sees it as like, they will not be running this restaurant forever because they were able to
invest. This is your escape hatch.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So yeah. She's, I think that, I mean, she's very proud. And Mark's parents are very proud, but they also like don't want to see us, you know, cutting vegetables when we're 65 and hustling tables and bartending. They don't want to see that for their children. So I think that we made good decisions along the way and we worked really hard knowing that the restaurant was going to be our priority, but we still needed to have a something to fall back on.
Yeah. So a diversified portfolio of, of work.
Yeah, you got to have a plan. You know, we know we're not going to do this forever and that we also want to have something that when the day comes, we can turn it over to, you know, someone that, you know, that has a new vision or someone that has new ideas. You know, maybe it'll be our kid, maybe it'll be someone else. So, you know, so it's all part of a larger plan. You know, it's, you know, we're gonna run out of motivation ideas someday. And when we do, it's, you know, it's time to, you know, it's like rock and roll. It's time to pass the torch to someone else. And so we want to make sure that we can do that in a manner that suits us best and, you know, stay devoted to what we're doing while we're doing it. And when the time comes, you make plans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I know that it's kind of the vision for your own space, meaning a space that you built yourself, you know, not being quite so dependent upon, you know, on leasing a space and like being able to do what you wanted to do in your own space. That have been percolating for a long time.
I think what what happens is, and I'm sorry, I cut you off, Lori.
Oh no, that's okay. I was just curious if that idea, like how much that predated, like, cause you ended up and I'll say lucking out because, you know, this space came up like virtually next door to you.
Yeah, and it was already sold. Or they had already had an offer in on that space by somebody else. So I think we were lucky. And it kind of, you know, it didn't just fall into our laps, but we're hands-on people. And as many restaurant owners that lease space can attest to, some of the landlords that, you know, that you're renting from, they don't take care of the space. It's up to the restaurant, the chefs and the people in the building to do a lot of it. And oftentimes when you're in a space for a very long time, the landlord doesn't even come in like for years and years and years. So you're responsible for so much. And it gets to the point with financially and emotionally where you're like, wow, I'm taking care of this. And at the end of the day, I got nothing.
And because, it's not mine.
No. Yeah. And so
I'm putting money into and that's, somebody else's stuff.
That had been happening where we loved both of the spaces we were in, except when you start taking care of so much and it's coming out of your budget line items and everything, you're like, wow, like we're stuck. Mm-hmm. And so it probably, when that space next door came up, like we didn't have a huge vision for it because it's scary. Because, right, you know, you're just used to running a restaurant. It's scary to say, hey, we're going to build something or we're going to do something that we only admired from our landlords, you know, and saw what they were doing, but we could never have a commercial space. We never thought we were capable of doing it. So that's, for us, it was a large challenge for the last 2 years because we'd never built a commercial space. We have residential spaces, but not commercial. And just the complexity of it over COVID and the size of the project for us was overwhelming. We knew we could do it, but we didn't know how hard it was going to be. And of course, now we're on the back end. We're like, hey, let's do that again. But you know, now we just want to focus on running the restaurant and not building anything for a few years.
For now. Right. Give it a rest for a little bit.
Yeah, I was going to say, and never say never. You never know. Like, I mean, I think that's kind of how, you know, how things go. I mean, you take opportunities where you can get them. which probably is in part, you know, the story of why, you know, like how you ended up in Tucson, you know, with two restaurants and all of that. So kind of, and then I'm gonna ask the question, what's next? Not necessarily expecting that there is an absolute answer, but kind of what is the future?
Bunny sandwiches.
Oh, thank you.
We do it on our truck. It's the most stale joke in Milwaukee Vietnamese food. When are we going to start doing banh mi?
It is overwhelming whenever you put new menu items on, because your staff has to take on like the influx of orders on that new menu items, and just you're reorganizing things in your kitchen to get, you know, those ingredients absolutely in. So it is always stressful. We do it on the food truck every Tuesday at Chill on the Hill. Yep. It's easy on the truck, but to bring it into the restaurant, we're adding something. So I've been hesitant. Far like long term, we're really trying to continue growing the catering side and event side. And we were kind of what's interesting is that with COVID, our delivery and carry out like peaked at 60% during COVID. That like after dining rooms opened up, we were still doing like 60 or 70% carry out. Now, even with things pretty much, you know, opened up and everything's back to normal, we still do 35% in carry out.
Is that much more than you did
it's
prior?
It's a lot more. Yeah, like before COVID, we were maybe 10 or 12%.
Okay.
So
that changed. It kind of changed the model. Like people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We picked up a huge carry out market during COVID, and we figured because everybody's closed. Mm-hmm. And so we had that. And then we figured that once the dining room started opening back up, that it's like, okay, well, that was great, but now everyone's going to start coming back in again and we'll just go back to normal. But it really didn't. We only lost a certain part of that carry out business as our dining room opened back up, and we ended up with a lot more carry out from before. And so we kind of think it was when people couldn't go out to eat, they got carry out from their places they go to, but they probably started to look for, they got tired of it and they wanted to look for something else. And there's probably other places that were in the same boat as us. And all of a sudden, you know, you started seeing all this carry out business. And so we picked this up, I think, because people started expanding their horizons a little bit on what to get for food, because if you're getting carry out from the same three places, you got tired of it eventually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and I think some people have continued. And I think the places that are seeing carry out stick are the places that are good at it. You know, like I think people took note, you know, like when you have to eat across the city, you kind of take note, like what transports well, what's coming home hot and good, you know.
And we had actually bought we have a little delivery car so we can do in-house, you know, so things like that, that we never thought we were going to ever pick up in as part of the business. Like right now is our slow time, and we're lucky because we opened a new restaurant during the slow season. But we know that come September, it's going to be crazy and come cold weather. Mm-hmm. And we're going, man, if our carryout in the summer is 35%, what is it going to be in the winter when it's double and the dining room's full?
When we really do carry out business.
Has that changed at all? Because I know your new restaurant that you built has a patio. Has that shifted your summer business?
It has. I mean, our summer business was really was pretty not good when we were starting
off. That's why we did festivals.
That's why we did festivals. We got the truck together. We
festivals, food truck,
yep,
right?
Festivals, anything we could get our hands on. We'd go out and do it. We did some that we found that were incredibly great festivals. You know, we found like, Zoo a la Carte was very good for us. The Lakefront Festival of Art down at the Art Museum was really, really good for us. Chill on the Hill has been amazing. We've been doing that for 10 years now. It's been great.
Had you guys there, and I was very happy with what happened to me and what I ate.
Oh, yeah. No,
so much so I couldn't speak for a moment.
We've become a staple with that. So, and that was born of necessity, because our numbers really kind of went in the tank in the summer. We said we had to go out and hustle to make it happen. With the new location now, we are seeing a bit of a change with the patio helps a lot. It's great to have a patio in Bayview. We had a patio in our Tulsa location.
Anywhere, I feel like if you don't have a patio, like...
Yeah, I mean, we had one in Tulsa. We couldn't really. It was in the back. It was all fenced in.
People didn't know it was there.
They didn't know it was there. It wasn't ideal. We tried to make it work, and it sometimes it worked, sometimes it wasn't. This patio, it's out there. It's on a corner. It's right there, and so we pulled out all the stops on that patio to really make it something nice. And we have the garage doors that open up, so the bar is double sided. We have tap beer now, which we've never had at our Bayview location. So yeah, and it just lends to being a little more energetic in the room and a little more of a summertime space. And so I think that'll help those numbers. And and then come into late fall into winter, then it's just about keeping the place staffed and trying to keep up.
Right. Yeah. Fabulous. So because you've been around for a while, I'm going to ask, just out of curiosity, like, if you had to go back and do it all over again, would you still do it? And is there anything like that kind of, hindsight is 2020, that you would you take a different path one way or the other?
Gosh, we're quiet because we're going through 10 years of life.
I'm not a big believer in going back, we're having regrets about things, because I do think that ultimately you end up where you're supposed to be, right?
Sure.
But it's sometimes an interesting exercise, especially you guys didn't have the easiest trajectory,
Right.
Mm-hmm. But you had a mission and you pulled through and you're still here and so
I think that we don't look back as much as I'm a worrywart. So I think Mark could say that I worry every day that we might not make it. And I know that that's kind of a ridiculous thing, but it's like, hey, do we have enough to pay our mortgages the month or whatever the case is? And I am sure that we do, but I think that I'm just constantly worried of like one thing might tank us. COVID could have tanked us, or one bad review could tank us, or whatever the case is. So I'm constantly worrying about just the day-to-day things. So going back, I've apologized to Mark and said, hey, sorry, that was my biggest regret, and I'm sorry for it. It could have been a 5-year regret or a 7-year regret, but yeah, we did end up ultimately where we were supposed to end up. Do you have any, Mark? You're going off your list. He's like, check my list.
I never would have done this. I never would have done this in a million years, to be honest with you. I would have stayed in Iowa. No, I totally would have done it again. Absolutely. My thesis differently, I think the idea of owning our own space, having that control of our destiny, I think I would have maybe pushed to pursue that sooner. Maybe even over more so opening multiple locations. It's opening that second store is tough. They always say if you're going to open a second location, you might as well open 5, because it's just not going to, it's the same amount of infrastructure you need. And, and I've talked to people, there's people around here that have done multiple locations recently, and it's tricky. And, I think I would have rather probably focused on solidifying or getting something larger in Bayview built earlier and sticking with that. I just remember years back doing a Bayview bash and talking to, I think, John Nearing when we were getting ready to open a second location. And, it was later in the day. And I think, he was working the corn roasting grill there and, covered in corn silk. And, I think we all had a few drinks in us. And I said, yeah, we're going to open a second location. And John Nearing's opened many locations in the grocery business. He looked at me, he's like, that second location's going to kill you. And I was like, what do you, don't know what you're talking about. I'm like, you've been staying over the grill too long. And, but it was challenging. It was really tough. And so I think looking back, I think it would have focused on really driving one spot to maximize what we could do with it over trying to expand to a second or maybe even a third location without really having the vision to say, okay, now we're going to try to go for 5 or 6, or we're going to go to multi-city or something like that, which we weren't in a position to do. So that's my only thing. But I'm glad we're well wound up.
Yeah. It's interesting that restaurants are a lot like what they say about children, and that is okay, two is a really hard transition, because you go from one to paying attention to too. And then after that, I don't know, this is my friends telling me, you know, like, oh, number three, that's a little bit of an adjustment, but not nearly, you know.
Like four or five, just throw them
four
in the
four or five, yeah, like just because off. Things just yep. like you're just used to having to divide yourself. And I feel like restaurants are a little bit the same way. Like the biggest like growth is that second location. And then usually people just are like, okay, well, let's put three and four in because, you know, yeah. eventually it's not more work.
We have one wonderful system. Restaurant and one wonderful kid. So,
yeah. We're good with it. Yeah, I was going to say. So you're the smart people, you know, software. Yeah. And I just think, you know, I think owning one's own restaurant is probably seen as a luxury in a lot of markets. You know, I think Milwaukee still might be a manageable one, you know, but so many people lease, you know. I think we've seen kind of a rash of people over the last couple of years buying their buildings and owning their own spaces, mm-hmm. you know, because I think there's always an inherent risk. I mean, there's a risk of losing your space, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Your landlord sells or just decides to do something else with that property. And, like, there's no guarantee, you know. We've seen people whose businesses, you know, kind of were going down and the landlords weren't lenient about leases, you know, right. about mm-hmm. rent during the pandemic when everybody was struggling. So owning your own place is great.
you do control things more. I mean, also, you know, rent increases. I mean, you see it in larger cities, obviously, you know, Chicago, New York, things like that. But it happens around here also. And you just don't have that control. And once you have it, then, you know, we know also we have to keep the bank happy. If the bank gets their money, you know, to manage the mortgage, then, you know, we're good. And then we have something at the end of the day. You know, you can build a great restaurant brand that you might be able to sell. Mm-hmm. But in reality, no one's going to buy all your old restaurant equipment, not for much. You know, it's not, you can say, oh, I spent this much money on it. Well, you know, it's mm-hmm. 15 years old. Nobody's going to give you much. You know, it's depreciated. So you got to have something that holds its value. And I really think that's your brand. You know, that consists of your menu, and that's your real estate, mm-hmm. and that's really all in the restaurant business. I think that's worth much.
Yeah, yeah. I've had chefs say, you know, hey, I opened this. We bought the building. This is my retirement, right?
Yep.
Like, mm-hmm. And that's you know the investment that you make in an industry that is really, you know, unpredictable and crazy. I mean, if we didn't know that before, we figured it out in the last few years.
Yeah.
So.
Well, speaking of real estate, where can people find your real estate these days, whether in person or online, if they want to keep up with what you guys are doing?
You can find us two doors down from our original location at 2699 South Kinnickinnick Avenue on the corner of Kinnickinnick and Russell/Logan Avenue.
Yeah, because they're on a funny little triangular lot.
It's kind of this weird five-point thing. Because KK's diagonal. You get these weird intersections. So we are there. We're running. We've been up for about almost 8 weeks now. And we are.
And you'll see it because it's a big, beautiful thing right there.
Coming over the Hone. When you come over the Hone and you keep pushing up to KK, we're the first building you see. And every day I'm so proud of it because it's such a beautiful building. You see the patio and the flowers and you're like, I really want to go sit and have a beer or a glass of wine on that patio.
No, that's nice. And then how people follow you on social?
Yeah, we're on Facebook right now. We're kind of revamping our social a little bit. We're going to be doing a new website build.
We're old people, so we don't Instagram, which we should.
we got to get going on that. We got to get Instagram going on.
I too do not do much Instagram. It's like seven photos of my dog.
But Matt,
Charlie.
You're talking to Matt. Matt's an old soul.
The kids are TikTok and everything now. We got to get with it. So we're revamping our social a little bit to coincide more with what we're with kind of our new vibe a little bit, but we'll get that going probably into the fall.
Now people can find Huey on Facebook.
Yeah. On Facebook, or you go to or you go to HueyBayview.com. Yep, HueyBayview.com.
Yes, and I was going to say HUE.
HUE.
Yes.
So awesome. Well, really, really thank you.
Yes, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you guys. Thanks for having us.
Because it's these stories, you know, it's like I always say, like these podcasts are kind of like the behind the scenes, the conversations that sometimes don't make it into any of the articles when people are all distracted by the pictures of the beautiful food, right? Mm-hmm. So, but thank you. Thanks for what you do, what you've done. And I'm glad to see why still around. You know, 12 years later.
Appreciate it.
So,
thanks, Lori. Thanks for everything that you guys do as well. You guys have always been on the up and up, and you guys really treat everybody really well. So, we appreciate that.
Well, let's call the podcast. Another awesome conversation here on the Food Crush podcast, Lori. And that leads us politely. I am now very hungry, which leads us very politely into our food porn for today, which is an ode to hunger.
An ode to just that. Yeah.
Yeah. So just that very piece, sensation.
This is a piece by, fittingly, a Vietnamese poet, Susan Nguyen.
I think it's Nguyen.
Nguyen? Yeah.
I believe so.
Yes. I'm sorry, Susan, if I mispronounce your last name.
Yes, our apologies, Susan, as always.
However, it's a beautiful ode to hunger that you've written. And I can take this one if you'd like.
All right, yeah, have at it. I'm seeing a lot of proper nouns, so this is very exciting.
Proper nouns, there we go. Ode to hunger. Praise spam fried with fish sauce and sugar. Jackfruit, 25 pounds of it carved on newspaper, latex sap sticking fingers. Praise Kraft mac and cheese, small miracle of powdered cheddar, pork floss in the big Tupperware, Sara Lee. Praise soy sauce and rice, shrimp cup noodles, 3 minutes till done. Praise the soft insides of baguettes. The first star fruit pocketed and sliced to Chef Boyardee. To durian, sweet scent of garbage. To pickled mustard greens, lean cuisine. Pizza bagels after school. Praise women, infants, and children. Banana blossoms, heart thinly sliced in vinegar, drained of all color.
I like that poem because it's one of the few that makes references to things I eat on the regular, which is to say Chef Boyardee and pizza bagels.
It's an awesome mix of all the things that most people eat, you know, like things that people eat and then, you know, other things, you know, like spam fried with fish sauce and sugar.
Yeah, which, it's a fun ode to the diversity of foods one can eat.
And what people get hungry for, depending on
this is true. Food that people crave, you know.
Yeah.
People food that people get hungry for that they don't just eat just to eat.
So thank you for that, Susan. You did a really nice job.
You did great, Susan. And you know who else did great? I think we did great today, Lori.
And our guests did great.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, we are only as good as our guests, and our guests are always
Kat
great.
And Mark, thank you for coming on. And if you want to find more Food Crush podcast, you can find us at Food Crush Pod on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
But Lori, where can people find you?
You can find me all of those same places at Low Frederick, where I'm talking about food. I'm hungry. Always.
I made myself mac and cheese before this up for the distinct purpose of not being hungry during the podcast.
Good for you. Good for you. I am still hungry. I'll probably snatch up some food after this. But so where can people find you?
You can find me at A Man About Film on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And that's where you can find my musings.
And you should most of all go find some delicious Vietnamese food.
Absolutely.
That's the best idea.
Most important of all, we want to thank our awesome guests. We want to thank producer Gabe, our great unseen, unheard person of genius. And we want to thank you, our wonderful listeners, who, as always, keep cooking.